When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hour two of the game, Mitch Fortner, Troy Coverdale, and Owen Burke rocking that awesome lavender K-State hat. He's getting on the phone right now, Mike Hendricks, who writes for the Kansas City Star. He's not a beat writer for sports. He's actually a local government guy. So get an interesting look at the sales tax for where that money would go towards renovations at Arrowhead and a new stadium downtown Kansas City for the Royals did not go through on Tuesday.
Overwhelming loss, in fact. 58% of the voters casting no votes in that. And I don't know that I was all that surprised, but maybe by the number. I would have probably expected more along the lines of 53% voting no, given some of the polling ahead of time. But at 58%, that was a pretty overwhelming number in that vote.
Well, here are the details once again. This was Tuesday in Jackson County, Missouri, for the stadium sales tax, where it was voted no by more than 58% on Jackson County question one. That is, again, numbers according to the Kansas City Star. Jackson County residents that rejected the 3/8 cent sales tax for the Chiefs and Royals stadium projects. We're now joined by Mike Hendricks from the Kansas City Star. He'll fill us in on some of the details that went around this vote. First of all, Mike, thank you for coming on to the show. Were you surprised by the results that were out on Tuesday?
Well, a week or so ago, I was predicting 54% no, so it came in a little higher. But I got the vibe it was probably not going to pass long before.
So obviously, we knew what the Chiefs and Royals were wanting out of this. There were a handful of groups that took it very seriously about pushing why those in Jackson County should vote no. But what were the main reasons for those that were against the sales tax vote on why people should vote no?
Well, I think there was a slim minority out there who didn't want to give any money to the teams at all. But I think overall, there were two or three main reasons. And one was the lack of transparency. We went into this, or the voters went into this, not knowing where the rest of the money was going to come from. They knew they were going to get sales tax money, which might have been, we didn't even know what that was going to be, but there was some talk about maybe $300 million per project. Well, the Arrowhead was going to be an $800 million project with $300 million from the Chiefs, so that left a $200 million gap. No idea where that money was going to come from. Maybe the state, maybe not. The Royals was a $1.3 billion stadium. Maybe we get $300 million from the sales tax. Maybe the team would give $300 million. Where's the other $700 million going to come from? We didn't know. I think that was the killer. And there was also a number of folks who wanted to want to save the K Kauffman Stadium. They didn't see any need for a new stadium. Then there were a number of folks who were also upset about the location, which was not identified until after one day or 2 days after the Super Bowl, and more than a couple weeks after the election was set, and the location they chose had not been in the mix really for the last 2 years, and a lot of people didn't like it.
One of the aspects of that, Mike, that in looking at it from afar, I felt like that choice of the Crossroads District as a potential place for the new Royal Stadium really put this entire proposal kind of into a mode where it just all felt rushed. It didn't allow for a lot of the time for the normal development or even for the team to put together some of the basic process things that normally go into a proposal.
Exactly. Well, you know, when they in 2006, the Jackson voters approved a $425 million bond issue and the current 3/8 cents tax to pay for their portion of renovations to the to Kauffman and Arrowhead stadiums. They had the leases and all those numbers down and ready to go in January before they set the vote for April. In this instance, we didn't get the leases until last week. And even then, there were all kinds of blank spaces on it where the dollar signs were supposed to go. And then, like you said, the location was not chosen until after the vote was set. And it just, despite the fact that the Royals and Chiefs said, of, oh, this is a two-year process, and that that there are county officials who did not move fast enough. I mean, the whole notion that all these details were left up in flux until the last minute, I think, like you said, gave it a sense that this is being rushed and people do not want to rush into a 40-year commitment.
Mike Hendricks from the Kansas City Star is our guest. We're discussing the no vote that went through in the Jackson County question one on determining would there be a third 8th sales tax, cent sales tax for the Kansas City Chiefs and Royals for their stadium projects. So speaking of the money portion of this, what I'm also very interested to know about is clearly the Royals and the Chiefs would have a bankroll to push their campaign, right? I mean, they had Patrick Mahomes, Travis Kelce were involved in ads, saw signs. They had commercials during the NCAA tournament. Meanwhile, the group that opposed this vote, I'm not sure what they had backing them. Is there an estimate on the money spent on both sides for this vote?
The last count, and it's not finalized. We won't find out until like the 15th of April. But the Chiefs and Royals have put in $3.2 million. And the opposition groups, there were two of them. One was a group that was formed off of a Facebook group called Save Kauffman Stadium, Save the K. They, I think they had something like 15,000. And then the KC Tenants, a citywide tenant union, which has been was formed 5 years ago, has become politically powerful. They told me they had a budget of about $125,000.
Have you seen many votes like that? That's so different in what's, you know, how much money is available for campaigns.
No, but I'm not a seasoned political reporter, but I do know that at least in a lot of campaigns, political campaigns, money doesn't always make the difference. I mean, it seems like it should, but it doesn't. In this case, people felt a lot of voters felt that the campaign was had an implicit threat in it, in that they were going to leave, if the teams were going to leave the community or at least leave Jackson County if it wasn't approved, and people didn't like that. But when it came right down to the point that the aim of the campaign committee that the Chiefs and Royals bankrolled was called the Committee to Keep the Chiefs and Royals in Jackson County, which, when I asked former Mayor Sly James back in February, what do they mean by that? He just kind of, didn't really answer the question all that straightforwardly.
The interesting twist to that aspect to me is that you have, on a national scale, already people discussing, well, where could the Royals move next in terms of a national look at it? But there is the localized look that I think is even bigger in the Kansas City area, and that would be you've got the discussion of potentially something at Legends for the Chiefs, because Kansas has been trying to lure them across the state line here these last few years. The Royals might be looking at something across the state line as well. How much is Kansas going to be in play going forward for this, or are they going to come back potentially with another try at Jackson County in the near future?
Well, my view, and I don't know anything more than anybody else, but is that neither stadium will end up in Kansas, and I could be wrong. I do think, though, that the Chiefs have their eye on Kansas for, and have had, it is in the leases, implied in the leases, as Kansas or another location in the metropolitan area for a new training facility and headquarters. And while that may seem like small beans, those are big tourist attractions nowadays. The Dallas Cowboys have something called the Star, which is like miles away from their stadium, which is like a Hall of Fame and a small venue and for concerts and whatnot. And people and restaurants and et cetera, and people come in droves to that. And I think the Chiefs have something like that planned, and it could end up in Kansas. As far as the stadiums go, I mean, I guess that the Chiefs could end up with a stadium in Kansas as well. But my hunch is that the Royals will come back with another plan, because I think John Sherman wants to stay in Kansas City and wants something close to downtown, in a different site in that general area, perhaps. And that they will split up and have two separate bond issues or taxes, and one will be for the stadium and one will be for a refurbished Arrowhead. But once again, I don't know. I could be totally wrong, but that's my hunch. I've worked in this community for 40 years, and I have a sort of a feel for it.
Well, and there's also the aspect that John Sherman is a Kansas City guy. You don't want to be the Kansas City guy that moves the Kansas City Royals.
Exactly. And the plus, you know, as far as the Chiefs, I don't see the Chiefs moving out of the metro ever. I mean, they just got too much of a good thing here. There's Chiefs flags, you know, all over the place. Like, you know, imagine trying to establish a new fan base someplace else when you've got one already here that you've established for 60 years. The Royals, too, I don't know. I just don't see the Royals picking up and leaving. I don't see that in what John Sherman – I don't see that in John Sherman. I also don't glean that from his remarks. He seems like he's dedicated to staying here and making something work. I think he recognizes this campaign's failures.
And what was the voter turnout again? Was it pretty solid numbers?
It was 29% countywide. Hmm. It was 24% within the Kansas City limits, and 34%, I think, in like Independence, elsewhere in eastern Jackson County. So 29%. And a normal April election, or last year's April election, was like 14%. So, and they never get above 20. So it was a big turnout.
Well, it's very interesting stuff. Well, Mike, I really appreciate your look inside to this pretty big story for us. Really appreciate all the work you do covering this story, and thank you for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
It's Mike Hendricks from the Kansas City Star. Yeah, super fascinating. I think that was really what I was interested in most. First of all, just the money spent on the campaigns,
sure.
But also like who would be motivated percentage-wise, who's really motivated to come out and stand their ground on which way they think. I'd watched multiple reports that were done actually on opening day, because there were for the Royals just a few days ago. Actually, it's what, a week ago today, right? And people doing like outside stuff and like doing interviews with Royals fans. They're just trying to get a gauge on how people felt about it. And it felt like a really mixed reaction. At least that's what was reported on, that it kind of felt like 50-50. So I was not going to be really surprised either way on the vote.
One of the things that stands out to me, and I view this also with my fandom of the Colorado Rockies and my knowledge of that franchise and how fans go every year to games, and that's wearing off a little this year. They don't have a sellout tomorrow for opening day. But you also have thrown into the mix, besides those of us that are hardcore ball game fans, you have those that want to go to the game for the entertainment value. And because it's a good place to be on a pretty night in the middle of summer. That's where the downtown stadium aspect comes into play, I think, much more than just renovating Kauffman Stadium comes into play. That, and as we've talked about before, from a structure standpoint, the need to add luxury suites versus what is currently in place at Kauffman Stadium. 50-year-old stadiums weren't designed for luxury suites the way that they're utilized now. It's why you've seen so many stadiums and arenas cycle through so quickly here over the last 30 years. I mean, when you look at the structures of the stadiums alone and how different they're built than, say, what Dodger Stadium is, as an example, you can tell the huge difference there and in how those luxury suites are built. But there are so many different priorities in people's minds on how they want this to go for the future. You've got the fans that believe that the K belongs and still is viable. You have the and you have hardcore baseball fans that are of that mindset. You've got hardcore baseball fans that would love to see it downtown. You have just the general fan who might find it easier to go to downtown than they would all the way out to Independence. I'm thinking of Overland Park, just as an example, or someone on the KCK side. There are just so many different little push and pull points in terms of where all of this could go, but it all gets centralized into Jackson County is the only ones that was voting. All of these little push and pull points, and it's all centered on one group of people, and it was 25% of that group of people, the residents of Jackson County. That is such a tight window to work with in terms of something like this. And you're asking a very, I don't want to say small, but yet it's such a relatively small slice of the metro area. You're asking them to be the determining factor on where a stadium goes. At what point do they start to look at broadening that out in the Kansas City metro to where others pay the freight as well?
I mean, you got this one huge metro and you're looking at one county to fit a portion
exactly.
of that bill.
Exactly. Yeah. It's again, it makes very little sense. There is an organization along the Front Range of Denver that's called Dr. Cog, DR Cog, basically. But it's Council of Governments and Denver Regional Council of Governments. They all have a little bit of a hand in the stadium district. It's not all on the city county of Denver like this situation is with Jackson County. And I think that's helped over the years in terms of how they've looked at different things in terms of Invesco / Empower / you, whatever you want to call it, it's still Mile High to Me Stadium and Coors Field. Ball Arena was actually built by Kroenke himself. He paid for the whole thing. City has nothing to do with it. So two stadiums that are based city and county-wise in Denver, but you've got the metro that does a little more in terms of the suburbs that do a little more in terms of the helping to finance those than what Kansas City has.
I mean, I've been pretty open about how I feel about this, and that is I not that I would necessarily vote yes. I mean, I totally understand about people that are from that area that don't want to see the Crossroads District touched. But I've been in favor of a downtown ballpark. I've also been in favor of having a new stadium for the Chiefs on what that could bring into Kansas City for additional revenue. You're talking about a whole different ball game if you have a different stadium that you can put a roof on, because that's what everybody's doing now.
Sure.
Every new stadium that's being built is going to have a roof on it.
Except for Buffalo.
Well, they're idiots.
They love their snowfall, man.
Not worth it, if you ask me. But one last question about this before we move on and take a break here. Troy, if you're Laura Kelly, Governor Laura Kelly, and that vote does not go through, which it didn't, of course, what's your plan at this point? Because we know that the tax from all the sports bets, 80% of that is going towards, hey, sports teams, want to come build a stadium here?
I'm looking at it more what the legislative approach is, more so than what Governor Laura Kelly's approach is on this. And that's because it's the legislature that's going to have the bulk of the poll right now.
Correct.
Instead of what the governor, you know.
But they've been able to do things here, so.
Correct. But it's also not a very smart thing, and she wisely did not do this. You know, don't make a statement. Just let it simmer. Let it rest.
So I'm pretty sure meetings are going on about it.
But you do not want to look like you are the greedy folks who want to automatically yank the team out of Missouri and into Kansas.
Me? I'm showing up in a suit that's green, that has dollar signs all over it. And
I mean,
let's talk Chiefs and Royals.
Exactly. Like, you want to do that, but you can also play yourself right out of the negotiations by doing
well,
so.
Well, of course.
Yes, so, exactly.
So, I think, you know, if they keep stalling, I do think that she's probably going to try to swoop in, and I think it's a great idea.
Here's the point, though, that I want everybody to remember, and it is a big point, and it's why I think that there will be another pass at this, at least one more pass at this if you're the Royals. The leases are still in place through 2031.
Yep, January. Yep.
7 years from now. 7 years. That's a long time yet in front of us before anything is established. And it's why I think that the fear of the Royals moving out of town or the Chiefs moving away, that's overstated. It is absolutely overstated. It makes for a great storyline.
Well, I always took it as a scare tactic type of thing.
It is. As much as anything, it is.
Put the thought in your mind, oh, God, they could leave, you know, to get some votes out of it.
For years, that's been the game in Major League Baseball especially. Because, I mean, the 80s were replete with this. How many times were the White Sox or the Giants going to move in the 80s? Denver was one of the targeted places. Tampa was one of the targeted places. I mean, that's how those places got teams in the first place. They were on the list of places that teams were looking at if they couldn't get their stadiums right. Well, we saw the difficulty that Oakland has had getting their stadium situation right. Who wanted the A's? One place. Nashville reportedly wants the Royals. Yeah, good luck with that. Nashville, while growing, still isn't at a level where I think that it has the ability to support that along with hockey and NFL.
Was it Nashville and some other place, right?
Charlotte.
Charlotte, yes.
Which, again, and I don't say that to be derisive of those communities, but to me that's still like trying to squeeze something into Tampa Bay right now. And the Rays continue to pay the price for truly not having been truly not having been prepared as a franchise in an area where basically everybody was looking at the economic aspect of it and not at the fandom.
Yep. They can't put fans in the seats half the time. They had a playoff game last year and couldn't even, I don't think they hit 75-50% capacity for a playoff opener last year.
Had we not been leaving town that day, I would have gone. Just to go. Just
exactly.
To go.
Yeah.
Because I could have gotten into a playoff game. But, yeah, in general, it never has played out right.
We got to take a break. That'll wrap up the discussion on the 3/8 cent sales tax that did not go through there in Jackson County. The biggest complaint about Crossroads I heard about was Grinders. Because Grinders is right there on that Oak Street. Is it 18th and Oak? That was like real questionable if it would be in there or not. But Grinders is like, I've heard the food is amazing.
Oh, man.
But it's also a concert venue.
Right.
So I at least like to go there one time or two times and see a show before they tear it down, you know.
Better that than the strip club.
Yeah, they have a few of those down there, too, don't they? Uh-huh. I don't know enough about that portion of Kansas City to really say anything.
Would have no idea.
Doug McDaniel is a cat. That's next. It's hour two of the game. Mitch Fortner, Troy Coverdale, and Owen Burke. The Cats have their first player. We're talking K-State men's basketball. They have their first commit and now signee out of the transfer portal in Doug McDaniel. Guys, I like him. 5'11 point guard out of Washington, D.C. K-State's pretty stacked there at point guard now. Dede Ames, David Castillo, who has signed a part in this recruiting class, are all coming in. I think there's going to be certainly an investment in the guard and wing position, although the K-State will still need a five, most likely, is how I feel they will go. 16 points a game, shot 41% from the field this past year. He has played in 60 career games and started 52 of them, including 26 in each year. That includes a true freshman year. Try to explain quickly his story here real quick, because I think I did explain it earlier this week. But if you didn't hear the show, first of all, go to Spotify or go to wherever you get your podcast and search for The Game on 1350 K-Man. Subscribe and download every show. So his freshman year, he was not a starter, but he ended up in the starting lineup because of an injury to the starting point guard for Michigan 2 years ago. Had his struggles, but still averaged 9 points, 4 assists a game, shot 35.5% from three, and averaged about 31 minutes per game. Got a lot of experience out of that, but was looking to improve. Because that freshman year, you know, if there were weaknesses that would pop up, it would be forcing passes, forcing three-pointers.
Yep.
And on the defensive end, because Jerome Tang earlier today was praising in a statement Doug McDaniel and his defensive play, but he would kind of fall asleep on defense. He would get a little bit lost, forget about his assignment, and all of a sudden the guy's wide open and he scores. And I thought Buddy Rich struggled with that this past year, although we didn't really see a whole lot of him, and I don't know if that was necessarily the reason. The guy could rebound and dunk like an animal. In year two at Michigan, was able to overcome a lot of those defensive mistakes. The three-point numbers got a little bit better, and the passing got better. The stat line for Doug McDaniel in his second year is solid. 16 points, 5 assists, 4 rebounds. That's per game. Shot just about 37% from three, and he was taking 6 threes a game. The assist-to-turnover ratio was really good. He played about 35.5 minutes a game, 2.5 assists, or rather 2.5 turnovers a game as a point guard, playing that amount of minutes. You will take that. And he's not even done growing as a player. That's where it's really exciting, and there's a couple of things that really stand out to me, and I'll get to you guys here. Two things that really stood out the most. Obviously, the numbers really show that he can shoot the three, but I'm really actually impressed by his mid-range game. The mid-range from the baseline on floaters to it looks like he's going to drive, but then it's kind of like a floating pull-up from the elbow. Swish, swish, swish. He had a pretty good clip. I think it was 44% from mid-range jumpers. I was like, okay. So that really showed to me, that's what popped on film, that he can score from all three levels. And then the passing really stands out. I think Mason mentioned this in the first hour. I can't remember. But, Marquise Noel was obviously the best passer K-State's ever had.
True.
I'm not talking like that magician-like passing or the lobs and all that. It's a part of his game. But what K-State didn't really have was just that split-second think, long pass, either just in the offense or in transition. He's able to make those kind of plays, split decision thinking. He's more likely to pass than score or shoot in a transition situation.
One of the flaws that this team had throughout the season was that its passing game was not crisp. It just wasn't.
Too many forcing bad ideas.
Yeah. Exactly. It never was a good flow. And, when you go from Marquise and what he was doing in the offense and raising guys' games to this year, the fall off was tremendous. Was just tremendous. A player like this, like McDaniel, would have been exceptionally helpful in that area alone. Just, yes, cutting down on the turnovers in general would have been helpful. But to be able to get the offense moving much better because the passes are just are better thought out in a split second would have been exceptionally helpful just to make this team better this year.
See, my big takeaway from the first to second year with Marquise Noel here was that, you know, that first year, K-State didn't have guys that could handle his passing.
Right.
That last year with Marquise, the first year under Tang, everybody was on just on the same page for the most part.
It's something that if you watch any of Iowa's games in the women's Final Four or in the tournament to this point, and what Caitlin Clark is able to do, she really has had to help raise her teammates' games because her passing is so good. There was a fast break the other night that she was on, and Monica's watching this with me, and she's like, oh my, you know, just caught off guard by how good that pass was. Well, Marquise ran into the problem that first year of guys not being ready for the passes. Caitlin Clark has run into that same problem with Iowa. I mean, that's when you're playing with an exceptional player, that's going to happen. That's going to happen. We're not saying McDaniel is on that level. I really think, though, that just someone that could get this team into a much better flow, and you put him with Day-Day Ames out there, I think the two of them, from a passing standpoint, are going to be able to control things well, and that's before we even mention David Castillo.
Yeah, I think the first thing I saw and I noticed watching, like, that transfer portal highlight tape and trying to check out his game a little bit was – I was like, this is a guy. I'm watching all these clips, and I'm like, this looks like a guy that can run a five-out offense. Like, he gets to every level, and he can score at every level, and that's exactly what you want, because you want your defense collapsing in, and now we're kicking out. Now we're hitting corner threes. We're doing all these things. And when you have the guy that has the threat to pull up at all three levels, there's just so many things he can do. So I think his decision-making is going to be the biggest thing that affects how well this pairing goes, because if he can come in and play at that B+A- level decision making, kick it at the right time, take the shot at the right time, his layup package is also ridiculous. I don't know if he's going to have as many crazy up and unders, especially that Tyler Perry had towards the end of the season this year, but the floaters you're talking about off the baseline, some of those are absolutely insane off the top of the glass and in. So when you have a three level scorer that can make those decisions effectively and everyone's playing on a string, they are a complimentary piece or two away, just some real good shooters away from being a very dangerous team, I think, because I think they've got their facilitator.
One thing about it as well is that it comes early enough in the portal being open that you are able to get him enmeshed into things very quickly and be able to get your preparations in place for this summer and getting the parts in place for those workouts and getting to where everybody is working out together to try and iron out those kinks before you ever come close to playing a game in November.
Yeah, and I love the how early they added him also is because, again, if this guy is going to be the guy running your offense, this is how you want to build it timeline-wise of now you can go back into the portal or back on the recruiting road and say, look, this guy is running our offense. He can get to all three levels. He can score at all three. But imagine that night that he's hot and he has 20. Look at how open this guy in the corner is. That's going to be you standing here. This is your shot that you're going to be taking because he's going to draw so much attention inside. So they kind of get their quarterback, and now you can use him as a chip to bring in more of those complimentary pieces, more guys that can really light from downtown. And I think timeline-wise, it matches up perfectly.
That's what Jerome Tang said about Doug McDaniel earlier today. It's always a great day to be a Wildcat, but even better when you get to welcome a player like Doug and his family to K-State. Obviously, he's a tremendously skilled basketball player with a history of winning at both Paul Six, I guess, and Team Takeover. When you combine that with playing 2 years in the Big Ten at Michigan, it made him a priority for us as soon as he became available. Doug is not only a high-level scorer with the ability to create for his teammates, but a tough, relentless player who can also be a disruptor on the defensive end. our fans are going to really enjoy getting to know him and his family. I agree. Really agree with that. It was cool to see that video of him and his family in the bathroom. He's wearing one of the uniforms. He's wearing the lavender uniform. He's kind of dancing in the bathroom with his family, because I don't think they could do the – they can't do the like the photo shoots anymore, I don't think.
Okay.
I think that's a new rule. I have to go double check that.
Of course, too much fun.
But they made their own fun.
Thanks, NCAA.
And, yep. And he posted it to his social media. I was like, that is a really good sign. Mm-hmm. And I love that in the release video that they had the I can't actually even remember what this was from, but was a Bill Self. It's a great day to be a Wildcat or something like that. That was also mixed in.
Right.
I thought that was hilarious. To put a bow on this, K-State got a really good player. I mean, we're talking about rivals. They graded him out as the fourth best guy in the portal at the time. I think the industry ranking from On3, that kind of just brings all the rankings together, he was at 16 or 17. His film is really impressive. This is such an amazing start in what is a very important offseason for this team. And I agree with Troy about getting him in really early.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're talking about, this could definitely be a process that takes us into the late summer months of once again building this team back up, with going the rest of the way with this class in the portal. And I think we're at now, what, four, Scully? Three or four? I have to go double check that. But there's still a decent amount of spots left open. So, and there's still work to do. And it's not just about getting the guys here. K-State's also going and visiting guys potentially as we speak. All right, we take a timeout. When we come back, we'll finish things up with my thoughts on the Final Fours this weekend and Ask Us Anything after these words. Back on the game, Mitch Fortner, Troy Coverdale, and Owen Burke. Saw some Ask Us Anything coming up. Just to, you know, fell down a rabbit hole today because I had to do with the Final Fours. And I'm going to bring up a question again that I asked Mason in the first hour. Mason Voth from Kasen Online joined us for the first two segments. So that question is, which Final Four are you looking forward to watching the most? Now, I mean, I understand it's WrestleMania weekend, but I'm sure some will try to squeeze in some Final Four action while WrestleMania is going on Saturday and Sunday night. The answer to that question for me is really easy. The women's Final Four is, to me, way more interesting than the men's. And I look at it from a broadcaster's point of view, and that's because of storylines. Your storylines are going to gravitate around Caitlin Clark, obviously. She gets to the Final Four for the second straight year with Iowa. And her Final Four game, semifinal game, is against UConn. UConn's her dream school. Mm-hmm. UConn is where she wanted to go play college basketball. Gino Auriemma didn't even give her a second look. Had no interest. That might be one of the biggest coaching recruiting flops in history. I mean, maybe not really, but
I mean, it's definitely
it feels
notable.
Like it.
Yeah, it's definitely notable.
So that's a very interesting part of that. Plus, like, UConn, remember what happened with Oklahoma State women? J.C. Hoyt's team. They had so many injuries, they could barely put a team out on the floor, but they still did.
Yes.
They didn't pull a TCU.
Right.
They still played those games. UConn is in that neighborhood where they have a ton of injuries. They have three players in their starting five that'll play the full 40 minutes. They don't have much rotation, but they're still very deadly. And by the way, that game is going to feature two of the best three-point shooters in the nation. The other game is South Carolina and NC State. Now, I would imagine South Carolina is going to win and go to the national championship. You never know what will happen. But if it is a national championship game between South Carolina and Iowa, you have an undefeated South Carolina team that many will probably think is, if they go and win it all, one of the best teams in women's college basketball history outside of Storrs, Connecticut. Can Caitlin Clark get over the hump and win the national championship as the greatest women's basketball player of all time? To me, that clash is very fascinating.
Absolutely.
On the men's side, you have Giant Gonzalez versus Omos. That is a wrestling deep cut that I just gave everybody.
It's Giant Gonzalez and King Kong Bundy.
Well, Giant Gonzalez, no joke, was a wrestler in the early 90s that was, no joke, 8 feet tall.
Yep.
Out of Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
Zach Eadie looks like he could be from 20 different countries. And his face looks like it could really rock a unibrow.
Yeah, that's true.
And meanwhile, NC State has a player, has a five that plays like a ballerina. I thought that would get a bit of a laugh, but okay.
I'm sitting here trying to envision DJ Burns as a ballerina.
Is that Brian Boitano out there?
Yeah,
DJ Burns is a very fascinating watch. But that's the thing. I want to watch those two play each
other. That's the magic. To me,
Honestly, nothing when it comes to that Final Four. I don't care who wins or who. I mean, NC State, if they were to win, would be pretty interesting. But outside of that, to me, it's not very interesting because UConn is just rolling again. I love college basketball, but watching that again just doesn't – it's not too attractive to me. I'm much more interested in this women's Final Four and what it has to offer with storylines.
I also think that in a lot of ways, it comes down to the fact that we know who the stars are in the women's Final Four. And while in the men's one, you're talking about Zach Eadie and DJ Burns, and then it kind of just stops.
You're going to teams. You're going to good teams at that point.
Right. You're not talking Paige Beckers, Caitlin Clark, and just going down the list.
I mean, on the women's side as well, the coaches that are also in
exactly.
that. Don Staley and Gino Auriemma. I mean, it's pretty big heavy hitters.
Yep.
All right, let's finish up the show with Ask Us Anything. I wanted to squeeze in a question real quick because I saw this on Twitter. It's a lot of fun. Guys, when I say middle school dance, what song or songs come to mind?
Fireflies by Owl City.
Oh, not God. That is the worst song of all time.
Okay, come on, Mitch. That is the song of a generation. That's what that is.
How sad it is to admit, you know, that anything Air Supply.
You know what? I almost, with Lindsay, we almost road tripped to Dallas for a Christopher Cross Air Supply concert.
How sad is it that went over my head?
I want to see Christopher Cross.
Air Supply the Musical is on the way.
Oh,
why?
that's the best question of the day right there, my friend. That's Ask Us Anything. Why?
In my days of making sure that I had the collection for DJing dances and the like, Air Supply had to be in the mix. I did have to have that Greatest Hits tape in there.
My middle school, this probably has to do with a lot of middle schools during my time growing up. Get Low by Lil Jon and the East Side Boys.
Yeah.
Was a banger.
And also hung around.
In the club, 50 Cent. Those were just easy staples for a middle school dance. We have quick 2 seconds here to squeeze in a question.
One. So, and it might be too thought-provoking of a question to squeeze in, but if you could commit a crime and it would never happen again, what crime would you commit?
Man, are you trying to expose us
no,
here?
No, it's just, you know, it could be, you know, it could be perjury.
America's Most
no
Wanted?
One could ever lie in court
yeah,
again.
Yeah, well, it would never happen again because I'd be in jail.
Well, no. Nobody in the world would ever commit it again if you were to commit this crime. Perjury, lying in court. Could get rid of that real quick.
War. POWs. I don't know.
Wow.
It's a thought provoking.
Wow.
It's a tough one to squeeze in.
This got dark. For Owen, Troy, and Mitch, go Cats.